You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Polemicist, politico, pundit, public turncoat are just some of the labels that have been used to describe Christopher Hitchens. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and a visiting professor of liberal studies at the New School, the author of numerous books, most notably his recent international bestseller, God Is Not Great, and also looks at Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, George Orwell, Mother Teresa, Henry Kissinger, and Bill and Hillary Clinton. In his latest book, Hitch 22, a memoir, he turns a light on himself and reflects on events, both public and private, that have shaped him and his work. It's published by 12 Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
Very nice of you to have me back.
So why the wordplay with the title? What's the catch here?
The catch is not as magnificent as the one of my late friend Joseph Heller. But it's simply this: after a lifetime where I've had quite a number of what you might call commitments or allegiances to parties in some cases, to ideologies in another, I've arrived at a point where the only thing I'm really sure about is skepticism. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'm certain of, and the group of people I'm associated with, is the uncertainty principle, and so forth. And that might sound like a rather soft commitment to the Socratic idea that the more you know, the less you know. And being educated is understanding your own ignorance. But actually, it pits us against the newest form of totalitarianism, which is to say the people who believe they already have revealed truth and have all the information they need and only need one book. So it's actually quite an active commitment. But it is a commitment to, in a sense, non-commitment. And so that's the catch. And I like it for this reason, if I can say that for myself. In the rest of the book, I quite often describe moments in my life, encounters in my life, where the struggle has been to try and find a position that's consistently anti-totalitarian, which is a little harder than it might sound.
The whole matter of memoir has been controversial in recent years. Is it possible to be completely honest when you're writing about yourself? And a follow-up question would be, did you find the subject a bit more to your liking than Mother Teresa and Henry Kissinger?
Well, it's not possible to be objective, so that's one admission one can safely make. As to honest, other people will certainly be the judge of that. I'd still probably have to answer no in that one has to leave out a lot of things, and I couldn't put it all in. I made the decision to exclude anything that involved the privacy of anyone else in whom I don't have copyright.
Although you do write about some pretty private things about your family.
I do, yes, but the other thing is, I mean, that the copyright thing ends when people are dead, I think. I've always thought, as someone who's always trying to breach the copyright law.
You tell some very funny stories here. Were you a funny kid?
Reasonably funny. These are things it's hard to say for oneself, but I did discover when I was a little boy, because I was quite little, I was small for my age, and I was in danger of getting picked on in boys' boarding schools, that if you could turn a phrase back on someone, if you could be quick verbally, it could make up for being pickable upon, and you could get larger guys to back off. So that was my first discovery that words can be weapons.
That's because you didn't grow up in a tough neighborhood in New York. You could be the wittiest. You could have been Oscar Wilde, and the other kid would have said, oh, yeah, your mother,
yes.
And he would have won.
Yes. But
you were growing up in Britain, where perhaps wit was more appreciated.
I don't say I always won. I mean, I know when you describe that moment, I can remember things like – I can remember the times where it didn't work.
Your parents were very mismatched.
But they better not have mentioned my mother. I will say that.
Your parents were really mismatched. Do you think that that has played a role in determining how you turned out?
For sure, yes. I did at one point think of calling the book Both Sides Now. I'm glad I didn't. But my mother was – well, I should start with my father, actually. My father was about 12 years older than my mother.
You call him the commander.
He was known in our family affectionately as the commander because that was the rank he achieved in the Royal Navy after a lifetime of being at sea and at war. He had a very tough Second World War, sent a Nazi battleship to the floor of the sea, which is a better day's work than I've ever done, on the Arctic convoys to Russia and many other fights. And told me once that it was the only time in his life he'd known what he was doing, or felt he knew. Generally a disappointed guy from a very austere, rather deprived background, rather morose, not quick to make friends, let down by the Navy after the war when they downsized and let him go. He didn't know what to do with himself much after that.
It's kind of weird.
And sorry.
If your father tells you the only time he knew what he was doing was when he was in the military and you weren't around.
Well, that did cross my mind at the time. But I was so much brought up on the mythology of the Second World War and the valor, especially of the Royal Navy, that actually when he said it to me first, it didn't strike me as bizarre.
And he didn't go to college.
By the way, he didn't really know what he was doing because what he was doing in his most heroic phase was running guns to Joseph Stalin, which was not, I can assure you, the sort of thing he'd signed up in the Royal Navy, His Majesty's Navy, to do. But it happened to be the job once Stalin joined the war against Hitler. So he did it. But he never quite forgave Churchill for making him do that.
What were his politics?
Very right-wing indeed. Mm-hmm.
So was he
very?
Did he feel betrayed when you moved to the left in college?
Well, if he, I moved to the left before that when I was at what you would call high school, when I was about 16, 15. He didn't seem betrayed, no, and he never tried to talk me out of it. I'll give him credit for that. I used to think he must be disappointed in me because I'm no good at games or sports of any kind and don't care about them at all. He was quite good at sports. I'm no good at maths, and he was quite a good mathematician and physicist. I was everything he wouldn't have wanted in a son. But I think he thought it pleased my mother that I turned out the way I did, so that was all right for him. And I later discovered that I used to work for a magazine called The New Statesman, which was a left opposition weekly journal in London. And I later discovered, I don't think he ever knew, I found out, that he used to give gift subscriptions to this socialist rag to his old leathery old seafaring friends for Christmas. And saying, you might find this interesting, my son sort of writes an occasional piece for it. I was very touched to find that out.
Neither of your parents went to college, but what was that statement your mother made about you being part of the upper class?
Oh, well, yes. When I was it must have been 7 for this to be properly anchored in time. We've all done it, sitting at the top of the stairs in our pajamas, hearing the parents disagree. And I was eavesdropping on this with particular interest this time because the disagreement was about me. And my mother was saying we'd have to scrape together the money to send Christopher to a proper private school. No, none of our family had ever done that. So I could get to university and so forth. And my father was arguing very practically that we didn't have the money. And she said, well, we'll get it somehow, because I tell you this, if there's going to be a ruling class in this country, then Christopher is going to be part of it. And I remember thinking, I don't really know quite what the expression means, but it sounds okay. I was on her side. And of course, as she normally did, she won that round.
Did they have the kind of accent you have? Because you do have the upper class accent, the educated class accent.
Well, I wouldn't say upper. No, I don't sound upper class, but I sound, it's, it used to be called an Oxford accent.
Mm-hmm. Where, or Oxbridge.
Or Oxbridge. Whereas George Orwell says, in England, everyone is branded on the tongue. As soon as another English person opens their mouth, you can tell a lot about them. It's sort of both a curse and a blessing. Anyway, no, they didn't. But they sort of acquired it by elocution, as it were, and were very, very concerned that I didn't slip back into any slovenly usage.
My guest is Christopher Hitchens, whose latest book is Hitch 22, a memoir. It's published by 12 Books. You write very openly and with compassion about your mother's struggles. How aware were you about what was going on with her when you were in boarding school and then off to university?
Well, I knew that my father, who, as I say, was 12 years older than her and rather morose, bored her. And I knew that she thought boredom was the most terrifying, unforgivable thing. And she was, unlike him, rather vivacious. She had an interest in fashion. She was very beautiful. She had a couple of unsuccessful attempts to open millinery dress stores. She would have liked to go to the theater and have sort of sharp and smart cocktail parties. This is absolutely not the kind of world he wanted or was good at. But in those days, and in that class of person, among that class of person, things like divorce and separation were barely discussed. So it wasn't until after I'd left university and my brother had left university that she decided to give herself another chance and move in with another guy, of whom she asked me to approve. She was very keen for my endorsement. And he, unlike my father, was charming, vivacious, outgoing, could quote poetry, liked a good time, but also, like my father, was hopelessly unreliable, couldn't hold a job, had once been a priest of the Church of England, not that that's really a job, and was, I think, bipolar, manic depressive, something. Anyway, suicidal. So it all ended very badly, and this is the first time I've ever been able to write about it.
In which they thought it was originally when they died in Greece the police thought it was a murder suicide.
It was reported in the papers in London as a murder suicide. Yes, I went to Athens thinking that he'd killed her and then killed himself, and I thought that for a couple of days until I had to meet the coroner and go through the police records and see some horrible photographs. It was very clear that they and finally found a note that she'd left for me. It became very clear that they'd made a pact of suicide together.
It's difficult to lose a parent under any circumstances, but this really had to have been a terribly traumatic experience for you.
Well, it was appalling, yes, because I hadn't realized that she was that desperate. And the worst thing for me is that at the hotel, the switchboard had a record of her trying to call me in London several times. And I was young in those days. I just moved to London. I wasn't at home much. There weren't answering machines and cell phones in those days. So I've always been haunted by the thought that if I'd picked up, if she'd just heard my voice, I think it would have stopped her from doing it.
Now, he had been a former priest, as you say. Your feelings about religion are well known. Had religion played a role in your life when you were younger?
No. I mean,
did you know that your mother was partly Jewish?
No, the family secret was kept successfully from me and might have been kept forever if it wasn't for the circumstance of my mother's mother, Dodo, as we used to call her, Miss Levin, as she'd been born, as I didn't know, outliving both my father and my mother. So there was no further need to keep the family secret because it had been kept from my father, you see. He didn't know either. So again, I'm sure if she'd lived, my mother would eventually have had the conversation with me, but I can only speculate as to why she kept quiet about it. I think I do know, actually.
When did your attitudes about religion coalesce?
When I was at boarding school, religion is compulsory in British schools. It has to be taught, and it's also taught as revealed truth. It's not just the study of religion. And you have to attend services and so on. I actually didn't mind doing that. I quite enjoyed it. I quite liked the singing and so forth. But there came a day when I was about 10, when our scripture teacher, who was also our nature teacher, tried to fuse her two roles, and on a nature walk said, you see how everything's so lovely and green, the trees, the shrubs, the grass, and so forth. And that goes to show that God is good, because green is the color that's most restful to our eyes. After all, he could have made it purple or orange, and that would be very clashing. I was 10. I didn't know anything about photosynthesis. Didn't know anything about chlorophyll. Didn't know anything about evolution by random selection and mutation. But I did know enough to think that's obviously wrong. This woman doesn't know what she's talking about.
This is Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate with Christopher Hitchens, and we're talking about his memoir, Hitch 22, which is published by 12. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Christopher Hitchens. His latest book is a memoir called Hitch 22. It is published by 12, the publishing company that publishes just 12 books a year, one a month. What was it about the Cuban Missile Crisis that got you interested in world events?
Well, I must have been 13 going on 14. It was my first year of boarding school in Cambridge. And I was suddenly abruptly made aware that the world might come to an end. I mean, that's what we were told by our teachers, that this could be the last day of our lives. And a man called Richard Dimbleby, who is the, I don't know what one would call him, the Walter Cronkite of Britain, came on the air on the BBC and said to parents, now please, on the crucial night in October 62, do send your children to school tomorrow, because people were mainly going to keep their kids at home so they could all die together. So I thought, what the hell is this? Why should this be happening? I've hardly got started with my life. And I became aware that there was a president called Kennedy who thought it was worth taking this risk in order to have a quarrel over Cuba, where it didn't seem to me that he distinguished, American policy had distinguished itself enough, shall we say, to have the right to risk a nuclear exchange.
And that's now considered one of Kennedy's finest hours.
I simply don't understand. I've read Schlesinger on this. I used to argue with Arthur Schlesinger, I mean, I used to argue about it with him in person and in print. I mean, he describes, however, he's got no choice but to do it, Mr. Kennedy creating the conditions of a crisis by trying to overthrow the Cuban government by force, giving them the right, in other words, of self-defense, not able to tell the American people the truth about this, making it seem as if Russian missiles have appeared from nowhere, and saying he's willing to blow up the world on the point. I thought this was insane.
And so you made something of a major commitment to the Cuban Revolution, which will come as a surprise to some people
yes.
who have read some more recent things.
Yeah, well, I mean, not just for this reason and for a combination of others. I did when I was a bit older, when I was 18, 19. I went in the summer of 1968 to Cuba to go to a sort of work camp for young revolutionaries. Very exciting time. Che Guevara had only just been murdered. The war in Vietnam was raging. The beginnings of guerrilla warfare were starting in Portuguese and white-ruled Africa. Very nearly just overthrown de Gaulle in the streets of Paris. All this, guerrilla warfare breaking out in other parts of South America too. Really had the feeling the world was changing.
And people in this country did too. 1968 is a key year.
Absolutely, yes. I didn't get here till the following year, but I remember seeing some of the larger demonstrations. And of course, I should have mentioned, I mean, maybe the most salient thing of all that year was the extraordinary crisis and splendor of the American civil, grandeur, I would say, of the American civil rights movement and the murder of its leader. But also, as always in my life, there's a struggle within the left. And the form it took that year was the fight between the Czech and Russian Communist parties, which culminated in the invasion of Prague in August when I was still in Havana, and a huge fight within the left over that.
Did you ever come to regret your views on Cuba in the light of Castro's increasingly totalitarian approach?
Oh, well, I've written a lot about it. I've been back several times since and written a lot of criticism of that regime, which is now, it's a parody. I mean, it's now the only uniformed regime in Latin America. It's the only one that doesn't have elections. It's extraordinarily isolated and backward. And when I went to plant coffee seedlings to try and, that's what we were doing in the hills in Pinar del Rio, to try and break the dependence of the Cuban economy on sugar, the colonial status of its economy. You still can't get a decent cup of coffee in Cuba. You can't reliably get one. It's so full of rationing and corruption and incompetence.
So,
in fact, at the time, I mean, I had quite a lot of quarrels with the Cuban leadership, but I thought, look, the Cubans have broken away from the most powerful empire in the world. They've put an end to a long period of colonial dependence. There was much to admire. They've done a lot to tackle racism, things like this. I was impressed with, but it still reminded me too much of my boarding school. Worship of sports, terror of the headmaster, martyrdom of Che Guevara, you know, described as if he was still alive, a quasi-religion. All of these things I didn't like.
What did you do after you left university?
I moved to London and tried to start getting paid for writing.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that that's what
were
I
Were you
had
a success from the start?
No. I was box office death in every way. I was abnormally bad at it. Unpromising, ungood. But I wasn't unhappy because I knew that this was what I had to do.
But to some degree, it's a matter of finding a voice, isn't it? Because it's you probably were
that.
Writing the same kinds of things you wrote later, but when you write them in a voice that's effective,
yes.
People want to buy it and read it.
Well, you're very kind to say so, but yes, in fact, I put it more modestly. Do you remember Richard Hoggart in a book called The Uses of Literacy? Great book. Very important in the evolution of cultural studies and so on. His son, Simon, was and is a journalist at The Guardian. And when I was working at The New Statesman, because I had found a bit of a job by then, he told me one day, we were having dinner, he said, quite a good article you wrote this week. And I agreed with it, and it was forcefully argued and so forth. It was a bit boring, so I bridled. And I said, what do you mean boring? The test is, does it make the case for the left? Does it, you know, land a good punch here and there? I don't care about the style sort of thing. And he said, no, you don't get what I'm saying. He said, it's much more amusing talking to you than it is reading you. And I thought, well, that's a trivial point. You know, what am I supposed to be, an anecdotalist? But It never left my mind, that thought. So now I try and write as if I'm personally addressing people. And every now and then, people are kind enough to say, I felt I was being talked to in your book. And then I feel this worked.
Well, since George Orwell is so important to your way of seeing the world, I would have assumed you would have just imitated him, as so many others have.
I wouldn't have dared try. And also, I thought you only earn the right to write in his very personal, spare way by having been him for a long time. You can't just assume that right. So I was doubly nervous of trying anything like that.
My guest is Christopher Hitchens. His latest book is a memoir called Hitch 22, and it's published by 12. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You cite some world events that have changed your political views. Can you start by talking about what happened when the Ayatollah Khomeini issued his fatwa against Salman Rushdie?
Yes. For me, the 14th of February 1989 was a hinge day, because on that day, as your listeners will remember, or many of them will, the theocratic head of a foreign state offers money in his own name to suborned murder. This murder to be of a writer of fiction who lives in London and isn't an Iranian. And I thought, well, when I got that news, and even if Salman Rushdie, the man in question, hadn't been a friend of mine already, I would have thought, I know, that well, this is the most frontal challenge it's possible to imagine to everything that I regard as worth fighting for, as precious.
We actually had an odd experience. He was booked on the show, and it was canceled at the last minute, partly because the publishing company was being picketed and they were afraid they were going to be bombed. They had actually been told to leave their offices.
Well, I describe in my book, I have a whole chapter about Salman and the importance of that fatwa and the resistance to it. I describe there was a terrible atmosphere of panic all around New York that week. A lot of writers, quite famous ones, Arthur Miller, I'm afraid to say, being one of them, initially wouldn't sign Susan Sontag's petition against the suborning of murder for pay of a writer, because they were afraid. They were rattled. The American government was rattled. Bush said it's nothing to do with us. It's, you know, no American interest is involved. Didn't want to comment. Most of the churches came out more or less for the Ayatollah, not for the fatwa itself, but for saying the problem is not the attempt to murder a writer. The problem is that the writer is a blasphemer. The problem is the book, in other words.
They blamed it for being a provocateur.
Unbelievable, across-the-board capitulation. So it was very exciting and very depressing to take part in the effort to combat this crying before they were hurt mentality that so many people now have about things like, it comes up all the time, the Danish cartoons, for it was the most recent salient example, or the ridiculous decision of comedy, contemptible, cowardly decision of Comedy Central to censor a cartoon show because it might have made a joke about the Prophet Muhammad.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who collaborated with Theo van Gogh on a film that led to his assassination, eventually was drummed out of the Netherlands on what seems to me to be rather false charges.
Well, yes.
Winds up here.
And winds up good for the USA for taking her in, but she still has to have bodyguards wherever she goes. She's a good friend of mine, too. I had her as a guest at my citizenship ceremony when I became an American a few years ago. She's a wonderful, wonderful person.
Now, she cites 9/11 as a turning point in her thinking, and you do as well.
Yes.
Well, what did 9/11 teach you?
Well, it didn't teach me anything I already – sorry, it didn't teach me anything I didn't in some way know, because I knew that something was coming, but I didn't know what it was going to be, of course, and I certainly wouldn't have believed anything so close to the heart, a blow as near lethal as that could be landed so easily.
Well, after 9/11,
it also confirmed my fear, the fear that had been building in me since 89, that a lot of people on the left were going to take a shady attitude to it.
Do you think they did? I think pretty much everybody was shocked by 9/11.
Shocked, yes, but it didn't take very long before you started hearing people saying cheap, stupid things like it's the chickens coming home to roost, or if only the Palestinians had a state, this wouldn't happen. I mean, unbearably foolish things on a level of it. Talk like that said it was that America had invited the attack should have been left to people like Falwell and Robertson, who were first out of the trap, of course, as you'd expect, and said it was God's punishment on the country. That sort of nonsense should have been left to those sort of people.
Instead of a Mary Baraka, you mean?
Instead of a Mary Baraka or Noam Chomsky or Michael Moore saying, well, you know, we've done worse ourselves. Quite entirely missing the point. And giving and conveying somehow the impression, often without precisely saying so, but without denying it either, that, well, look, this is a movement of brown-skinned people in the third world. It must have something good about it. It's anti-globalization, at least. It's better than nothing. And sometimes that's explicit. I've had debates with anti-war spokesmen like George Galloway, for example, in front of big audiences in New York, where the man is essentially an advocate for jihad. The rot's gone very deep, and that's what about half my book is about.
Well, both sides. You were using phrases in The Nation like, you said, called fascism with an Islamic face.
Yes.
Islamo-fascism, the sort of thing that Rush Limbaugh actually says.
Rush Limbaugh wouldn't be capable of saying fascism with an Islamic face.
No, but he did say Islamo-fascism.
Well, that's not my kind.
So somebody
that sounds a bit more... obviously, you can't say fascism with an Islamic face all the time either, but I took care in my column to say, with a double allusion to Susan Sontag and Alexander Dubcek, that I thought it was possible to mention the two in the same breath. Violently anti-Semitic, cult of aggression and violence among the young, cult of martyrdom and suicide and murder, nostalgia for a lost empire, the caliphate. This is very comparable to fascism.
Well, the big break with people on the left is when you, a member of the International Socialists, wound up supporting the Bush Doctrine, which is an interventionist foreign policy. Why were you such an early and ardent supporter of the war in Iraq when Iraq really had nothing to do with 9/11?
Well, no, early, you're quite right. That's what makes the support early. And I would rather say a supporter of Mr. Blair than Mr. Bush, just as a matter of record, because after the defeat of Slobodan Milosevic and his overthrow in the late 90s, Tony Blair made a speech in Chicago in 99, when Bush is governor of Texas and probably doesn't know where Iraq is, saying, it's good we've got rid of Milosevic, but we still have totalitarian, aggressive, destabilizing enemies, and one of them, the most salient one, Saddam Hussein, will have to be dealt with one day, which was also the line, if you remember, of the Clinton administration, the Clinton-Gore administration, which caused Congress and caused the House and Senate unanimously almost pass the Iraq Liberation Act, saying it should be our policy.
Why
to help the Iraqis into a post-Saddam world? That's well before 9/11 and nothing to do with it. You're quite right.
But why Iraq alone? Why not invade North Korea or Iran or Burma or Zimbabwe? And I probably can list six or seven other countries.
So could I.
Where people were no worse than Saddam Hussein.
You couldn't. You except North Korea. You couldn't say that. You and I both know why North Korea can't be invaded, because it's insane and it has nuclear weapons and we can't predict its behavior.
Well, Burma, we could invade Burma, and they're killing their own people
regularly. I would not be against an intervention in Burma at all, or Zimbabwe. I wasn't. The question was, should there be an intervention in Iraq? And it's, if you'll pardon me for saying so, it's just changing the subject to say, well, let's not discuss that. Let's discuss another country. No, why don't we discuss Iraq?
Okay, well, it's been pointed out that it's one thing to believe that a regime should be toppled and another thing to invade a country and occupy it for years, resulting in the loss of many lives on both sides,
yes.
Especially since Saddam Hussein posed no real threat to the rest of the world.
Well, I have a whole chapter in my book about – I've been going to Iraq since the mid-70s, since the time Saddam Hussein first seized power. And I was very opposed originally to to the first President Bush and what's sometimes called the first Gulf War. I was very publicly and very actively opposed to that. And I go to a lot of trouble, more than I can probably take on this airtime, to explain how I changed my mind. So if people really want an answer to your very good question, the one you just posed me, I hope it won't sound hucksterish if I recommend that they read that chapter of my book. It is quite long. It does contain quite a lot of reasoning and evidence. But I would just say the four reasons that a state can sacrifice its sovereignty, I'll say this quickly, are invasion and occupation of other people's countries, genocide, messing around with the non-proliferation treaty, and giving sustained aid and comfort to international terrorist groups. As a matter of fact, only the Saddam Hussein regime meets all four of those criteria and met them several times. I was intending to meet them again, in my judgment.
many people in all the reviews have noticed that you reveal that Bill Clinton did take drugs, although he didn't inhale. He was actually telling the truth.
Yes. When I first heard him say he tried them but didn't inhale, like everyone else, I laughed because he didn't say he didn't try. He just said he didn't inhale because I happened to know the story. I had an additional reason to laugh. Bill Clinton doesn't inhale. He's allergic to smoke, among other things. But he quite likes brownies and cookies, and some of your listeners will know what I mean by that.
You also tell the story about getting a spanking from Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, I've had physical contact with Mrs. Thatcher. Baroness Thatcher, she now is.
Were you an admirer?
Sexually, I was, not politically.
You thought she was attractive, physically attractive?
I wrote, when she was first elected as leader, most of the press, almost everyone in the press, thought the Tories had gone mad and they'd chosen this shrill suburban housewife. Everyone wrote in this rather snobbish way about her. Well, they must have been wrong, mustn't they? Because she went on to change the course of events very dramatically and British society. And I thought I was earlier than most to see that she had something charismatic, I would say, that was partly sexual. She had the most beautiful skin I've almost ever seen on a woman.
Well, people say the same thing about Sarah Palin. Do you support Sarah Palin because of that?
No, she has got no charisma of any kind. I can imagine her being mildly useful to a low-rent porn director, yes.
you revealed
Mrs. Thatcher, you see, would be no good in that way.
Yeah, probably not.
No, I mean, you can't picture it, can you? But you've already pictured Sarah Palin, haven't you?
You have been accused here of being a name dropper.
Well, sure.
That's okay? Is that what a memoir is for?
Well, I suppose I could have left out all the interesting people I've met. All the funny things they've said to me. I must say I don't think that's a criticism. I'll try and do better next time, write a book that is devoid of interesting people or amusing stories.
You also talk about drinking. It's a way of lubricating the tongue, making you feel wittier.
No, I can talk without it, as I'm doing now, in fact. It must be noon fairly soon, I feel.
I have had a few guests who came in.
Plastered.
Yeah, rather plastered.
Well, no. I mean, I don't slur even when I have had a few drinks, but if you're even slightly whiffled, I think it would show on the air. The microphone would pick it up. No, I use it. I don't need it to talk. I don't need it to write. I use it, as I say, rather snobbishly, to make other people less boring. It does help there. And of course it can. And of course it can prolong and enhance. If everyone is being interesting and you're at a nice dinner party, then if you want to prolong and enhance the moment, then alcohol is a very nice way of doing that, as long as you don't make it become your master. Keep it as a servant.
Well, there seem to be two themes here. One, you mentioned earlier about your mother saying that the one unforgivable sin is to be boring. Mm. And obviously you don't want to be boring. You don't want other people to be boring. There's another one, which is that you are often combative. Do you see the two as connected?
Yes, and it's probably, I say in my answer to the Proust questionnaire, which I set for myself, I say it's probably a vice because if it's a virtue at any stage, as in public debates and so on, I suppose it does come in handy. It's a vice in the rest of my life. I find I don't like to lose even very small arguments, even with taxi drivers or spouses or friends, even if it's a negligible question. I hate to give in. I hate to concede.
I think that
makes me probably objectionable.
What do you do with the cab driver when he offers you a good objection to your support for the invasion of Iraq? Simply say, read my chapter?
No, because I'd have time. I can't read the chapter aloud, but I would probably, if he would turn off the meter, I wouldn't leave until he knew everything I thought about the subject. I mean it. I mean, I've done that.
Well, you're going to have to leave now. We have run out of time.
What a shame.
Christopher Hitchens' latest book is a memoir called Hitch 22. It's published by 12. Thank you so much for being with us
again. It's very generous of you to invite me back.